A little bit of background first, for those of you who weren't in the Roman Catholic presentation last week. What you have to keep in mind is that the Roman Catholic Church, for many centuries, approached other religions in an extremely negative way. With the banner flying, upon which was emblazoned, extra ecclesiam nulla salus est. Outside of the church is no salvation. And the church was conceived of symbolically as a boat. So how can you be saved if you're not in the boat? If you're not in the boat, you're out in the water drowning, right? So God has placed the boat there so that people can get on it and be rescued. That's the image. Outside of the church as a boat, there is no salvation. A Protestant way of saying that, an evangelical Protestant way of saying that, is extra Christum nulla salus est. It really works out to the same kind of exclusivism, doesn't it? Outside of Christ, there is no salvation. So outside the church or outside of Christ, one is still out there in the darkness. One is not in the light. This is Karl Barth. Barth says that the light of God is in Christ, is shining on Christianity, and it is not shining on the other religions. I mean, that's a very wooden view of Barth, and Barth is a very subtle thinker. But that is one of his chief understandings, that you don't go to the other religions for salvation. Salvation is found only in Christ. Now, this was the typical attitude up until Vatican II, 1962 to 1965, Vatican Council II. At that council, as Pope John the 23rd said, the windows of the church were open to the world. And one of the things that happened was that a more accommodating theology of religions began to be formulated. And Hans Küng represents one of those theologians who is taking the insights of Vatican II, the ecumenical Catholic insights of Vatican II, and taking them very seriously in his theology, in his ecumenical theology. The word ecumenical, by the way, is many times used in an intra-Christian way. And I don't know statistically, but I think it's less used outside of the Christian ambit. But I think numbers of religious studies scholars would want to talk about ecumenicity and Catholicity in terms of all the religions and not just the Methodist Church having Lenten service with the Presbyterian Church. That certainly is ecumenical in a way. But King is, quote, far beyond that in his Catholicity and ecumenicity. Well, how does King approach Islam? He approaches it from this point of departure, which we might call his overall aim, and that is a Christian self-criticism. Christian self-criticism in the light of the religions, and Christian criticism of religions in the light of the gospel. So, immediately this places him in the camp of the dialoguers. Now, we have talked about some monologists, and Barth would be an exemplar of one style of monologue or proclamation theology of other religions. One proclaims the gospel to them, but one is not essentially openly listening to them. Here, King says we should be in dialogue for mutual edification. So this is taking the religions and more better said, religious persons in other traditions very seriously, and not understanding them in a missionary sense, which is that typically we compare ourselves at our best with them at their worst. So we talk about our saints and about their sinners. We talk about our strong points and about their weak points. This is kind of a 19th century pre-Vatican II, shall we say, missionary strategy or approach. And it's worth mentioning here also something that I've said several times in previous sessions. One of the chief differences between the present day and the situation even 50 years ago and certainly 100 years ago is the increase of knowledge of other religions. We simply know more about other religions, vastly more than we did just a generation or two ago. And those other religions and other religious or persons of other religious persuasions are impinging on us and on our consciousness in a way that is unprecedented in the history of humankind. So some people want to see this as an axial period or revolutionary period. Let's say one period might be Christianity as it emerged from Judaism and encountered Hellenism. Maybe a second period is when Christianity encountered science in the mid-19th century. And maybe the third revolution or the third revolutionary period is happening now, when Christianity is encountering for the first time in this self-conscious way in history other religions. Certainly they've been encountered before, but not at this level and not with this kind of self-consciousness. The consciousness that the globe is small, that the religions are enduring, that they produce faith, hope, and love in their adherents, that they are likely not to go away, and that it is better for us to cooperate than to compete because of what we see happening on the earth, which is what Holden certainly is emphasizing, the destruction of the ecosphere, etc. Many people feel a compulsion. We are impelled to enter into this kind of dialogue, and not because it's a kind of superfluous thing to do or interesting to do. I'd like to know more about Hinduism someday. But rather, it's imperative for the survival of the race, for peace. Well, he says we have to engage in this dialogue in mutuality, to strive for a mutual critical enlightenment, stimulation, penetration, and enrichment. Now, you know, that takes a commitment to say a sentence like that. It also takes a commitment to deny a sentence like that. It is a sentence that flies in the face of Christianity's approach to other religions as it has been formulated for centuries, and as it continues to be formulated in, we might say, and I think Kuhn would say, and many like him would say, triumphalistic ways, Western ways, in which Christianity is blessed with, if not the whole truth, at least enough of the truth so that it can go out and convert other people to it, no matter what tradition they happen to stand in. This is a sentence that says that Christians sit in mutuality, in concern, in friendship, and even love. This is what Cantwell Smith says, even maybe love, and strive for mutual, and there's the word that is really the torpedo, isn't it? If you take this seriously, it's the torpedo of the monological, triumphalistic, Western, conversionistic, exclusive way of looking at the relationship between Christianity and other religions. Mutual enrichment. If you have the truth, or even if you say, you know, sophisticatedly, the truth has me, and you engage in dialogue with the other, with the outcome of the dialogue predetermined in your head, that the dialogue, if it's a full dialogue and if it reaches its perfection, will lead to Christ, and will lead to Christ in the way in which I understand him. as, say, the second person of the Trinity, the one in whom the fullness of God dwelt bodily. Okay? Anybody want to say anything about that? I hope that's clear, because we really are talking about something subversive here. And if it's coming across too mild, then something's wrong. Yeah.
Why don't you reread that sentence again?
King is saying that as Christians approach persons of Islamic persuasion, they should strive for a mutual critical enlightenment, stimulation, penetration, and enrichment. That this kind of movement is going on. Yeah. And see, for Kuhn, that's where it is. That is the locus of the dialogue. Whereas in the old model, you do this kind of thing. I mean, this has been done in Christian history, but you don't do this. You don't go through Indian villages with loudspeakers, you know, saying Jesus is Lord, you know, proclaiming the word to everybody. Of course, you listen to other people, but you listen for points of departure in which you can make the Christian case for that person's giving up their tradition and moving into your tradition. So it has a perfection, or it has an omega point at Jesus. Why this is revolutionary is because this is where it stays. See? It doesn't necessarily. I mean, if somebody wants to come to Christ in that dialogue, perhaps okay. But that isn't the point. And he makes this at the end of the book from which I took this. He says, you know, the era is over of Muslim missionary activity toward Christian, and vice versa. It's a mutual, yeah. Yeah, and in other words, he's saying, we're not going to go try to convert you, and you don't try to convert us, which is very important to say, because the Muslim population is rising rapidly in this country. Yeah.
Bruce, isn't it true, though, that Hans King himself is considered a little bit too off the wall by the current Pope, John?
Yes, yes.
Has he been silenced?
His license to teach as a Roman Catholic theologian has been withdrawn. He continues to teach, much like Charles Curran. That's another example of that class of people. Yeah. He continues as a priest. He's Father Kuhn. And, of course, he's booked up years in advance. So, you know, before we start getting him for summer break, Idaho, my program, July 9th and 10th, in the beautiful city of Moscow and the charming campus of the University of Idaho at the Campus Christian Center. Please come and hear Dean Tim Lull of Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary talk about 20th century theology. So anyway, yeah, he's alive and well, but his license to teach has been removed. Now, Matthew Fox is in a slightly different category, because he was not a teacher of the, he was not a Catholic teacher. How can I put this? He was not an official teacher of Catholic doctrine to the public, as it were, as Curran and Kuhn were. But he is a priest, and therefore he is under the guidance of a bishop, and ultimately of the Vatican. And he was silenced. That is, he is not to publish his views.
Seems remarkable that we have those prophetic voices within the authoritarian Catholic Church, and we don't hear very much in that direction from our own Protestant. I mean, what voices do we have that are strong?
Well, a John Hick, for example, within Protestantism, I think, is a very strong voice. Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm guessing that the vast majority of our congregations are somewhat threatened by this whole idea, because they're even threatened by somebody of another racial tint, let alone another religion. Are not comfortable with the heterogeneous congregation or inclusiveness.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's troubling and disturbing, and it is to me. And I'm not standing up here as somebody who has this all figured out. I mean, there are people like, you know, the Hicks and the Ponikars and the Ninny and Smarts of this world who have spent really a lifetime at this. Ninny and Smart, for example, starting the first religious studies department in Great Britain. That is, religious studies apart from the study of theology. Well, that took enormous will and purpose and skill and daring on his part. You know, and you have to kind of commit yourself to that. And I'm such a dilettante. You know, I mean, I'm running the Campus Christian Center and whatnot. I have not done the kind of in-depth reading, studying, and daring that these pioneers have done. So, you know, I want to be humble, which is hard for me to do. But I mean, this is a real humble statement. I mean, there are depths of shallowness that I haven't even plumbed yet. You know, you scratch me, and it's even shallower than you thought. So I'm a screen for other people's ideas at this point. On the other hand, I find them enormously exciting, because, you know, if you follow Christ, who is the truth, the way, the truth, and the life, then you must follow the truth. And our typical Christian pattern has been an assumption that we have the truth, and that it remains only for us to communicate that truth to people in other traditions. What Cantwell Smith and Kuhn and others, in their own ways, and that you can't, you know, blend them and homogenize them into one. And that's why we're looking at it from various angles. But what they are urging is that we seek truth in a global way.
Concretely, what does this mean? I mean, is he proposing some concrete action?
Absolutely. Not so much King, because I study King for other reasons, but I've been reading Wilfred Cantwell Smith, and he's suggesting very concretely that what he would like to see is an international sort of intellectual theological Vatican. He doesn't call it that, but, you know, it's a sort of curia, which would kind of be a sounding board for truth claims. Cantwell Smith doesn't like that term, but I mean, you know, claims of religious knowledge would not be understood only within the context of Hinduism or only within the context of Buddhist theology, but that what you're working toward is a global theology. And I'm going to be talking about that in the next couple of days, the next 2 days. So this is a good run-up for that. Not a global religion, you know, a syncretistic blender mix, you know, where you put all the religions together and push the blender button and, you know, and then you pour it out and it all looks the same. These people are not after that. But they are, what they're against is parochialism, including the parochialism of a very strong tradition in the West, which is secular humanism, which has its points, see? And so you could do a model of dialogue between Christianity and secular humanism. See, this model fits them all, it would seem. And secular humanism has its own biases, its own premises, its own axioms, which can be questioned. Ninian has a criticism of secular humanism, which is very telling. He says that secular humanism is very arrogant in thinking that it is the wave of the future and that the whole rest of the world is inevitably going to fall to its brand of truth, its understanding of truth. And that's not necessarily the case. Just as it is not the case that the whole world eventually will become Hindu. Or, as we thought in the 19th century, the 20th century would be the Christian century, hence the name of the famous journal, Christian Century. Yeah?
So So what they're talking about is getting people together, kind of like the World Council did with Baptist New Christian Ministry, except doing it a cross faith.
I was going to read this quotation at the end, but let me read it now because it's pertinent. He talks about the interconnectedness among religions. Try not to be confused. I try not to be confused. You try not to be confused. Between Hans Küng and Cantwell Smith. This is Cantwell Smith. But I think the tone of it is reflected in Kuhn's approach also. Here he says, and as I read this, this corrects something that I said in the Arab-Israeli gig. You know, I said that the Muslims picked up beads from the Christians. Not so. You'll hear about this here. One might begin with a widespread custom taken from our Paleolithic heritage and still vital today of burying the dead. Nearer in time, we note the presence of Zoroastrian motifs in early Christian writings, initially borrowed by exilic Jews. The New Testament is pervaded with Persian imagery in its drama of cosmic dualism. Berger mentioned this morning. Angelology, eschatological portraits of hell, and towering personifications of evil. If one turns to religious practice, one discovers that Wallenberg is wrong, and that in fact, Roman Catholics are indebted to Islamic influence for their use of prayer beads, while Muslims, in turn, are indebted to Hindu tradition. So the East moved west and deposited this bead business. And you saw in that slide after we finally got it going, you know, that old gentleman smoking the pipe had the beads. I think a lot of people in Arab countries use them as sort of worry beads. I'm not sure that they're actually, what they're supposed to be doing is thinking about the 99 beautiful names of God that are recorded in the Quran. You know there are 100 beautiful names of God. You know who knows the 100? Huh? I just got through being humble. No, it's the camel. And that's what gives the camel its dignity. The camel knows the 100th beautiful name of God.
And it's humble because it goes down on its knees.
It does, yes. It's a camels are Muslims because they submit. That's what Islam
means. They're all female. It wouldn't work, right?
Boy, I asked you not to lose in and can't well sit.
I'm getting my seminars mixed up.
Yeah.
Some of them overlap.
Let's see, you have the one-hump camel.
This is going to get worse.
Bactrian, right? And the two-hump camel is the dromedary. What do you call a no-hump camel?
Humping.
Yeah, as are Buddhists, indebted to the Hindus. In a striking illustration of intercultural linkage, Smith describes a visit to California in which he unexpectedly observed that Catholics arriving from Europe and Buddhists arriving from Japan both shared the discipline of prayer beads. The custom had become global, with participants unaware that they took part in a common inheritance. Many fundamental concepts, symbols, and practices found in the Earth's religions are transcultural. Though they are always appropriated in a unique manner, they cannot be said to belong to a single tradition. Christians cannot claim the symbol of God, or Satan, or the concept of Scripture, or the idea of prophecy, or the practice of prayer, or the ritual of baptism as singularly their own. Each of these items belongs to the Earth's storehouse of religious elements. Therefore, Smith asks scholars to rethink the meaning of all these items in world historical terms. That's the Baptism Eucharist Ministry idea writ large. If Christian intellectuals viewed their church's handling of the symbol God as but one of many participations in the evolution of a widespread symbol, they would arrive at a more total perception of humankind's experience of personal divinity. To reflect on the way each culture reworks transcultural concepts like God, grace, or prayer would lower psychological barriers between communities. So that's the project, a global theology. Well, where do we start as we mutually interact, Muslims and Christians? Well, we start with the understanding of Muhammad as a prophet. Muhammad comes on the scene, born around 570 CE. He has a revelation about the time of age 40. He's visited by the Holy Spirit, who is known as Gabriel, the angel Gabriel in the Quran. And he receives a commission from God to preach monotheism to the polytheistic people. He receives a message and a mission from God to preach what he came to consider original pre-Christian and pre-Jewish Abrahamic monotheism. And that is one of the key, quote, missionary selling points of Islam. You know, they will say, well, you know, you Christians have some of the truth, you know, and Jews certainly do, but our prophet preaches the original Ur message, the God of Abraham. And Muhammad himself says, I am neither Christian nor Jew. I'm a third thing. I am, you know, representing the original revelation. So Muhammad is a prophet of God. And as Berger has pointed out in another context, the Quran that came from the mind of Muhammad at the impulse of Allah is structurally parallel to Jesus in Christianity. So that when you ask the question, where is the locus of God's revelation? Christians want to point first to Christ and then secondarily as a medium to the Bible, is instrumental in bringing the Quran into the world and giving birth to the Quran. But the Quran is the Word of God in a very sort of fundamentalist sense, that there's a direct correlation between the Arabic language and the revelation of Allah in the Quran. And you get theories of the pre-existence of the Quran, and you know it's very interesting how some Islamic theologies talk about the Quran. They're very similar to the way some Christian theologies talk about Jesus. So you have Jesus, you have Muhammad, and you have the Quran, all testifying to belief in one God. Now Kuhn says that's the place to start as we talk with Islam. All three, Jesus, Quran, and Muhammad, stress God as active in history. All three say, yes, God transcends history, but God nevertheless speaks through prophets, reveals God's self through historical events, such as the Exodus, and such as the Battle of Badr. That is a famous battle, which was a turning point in Muhammad's fortunes. Muhammad, having been a rousing non-success in his hometown of Mecca, and isn't this the way it is with all prophets, huh? You know? And I mean, that's certainly a starting point for dialogue, isn't it? We can all sit around the interreligious table and say, yeah, our prophets get killed, our prophets get not believed in, you know. To be a prophet is to be in a not a good insurance position. You probably can't get insurance if you're a prophet. So according to that tradition, Muhammad is right in there with the best of them. The Meccans tried to dispose of his message of monotheism, which was a big threat, as I see it, to the economic welfare of Mecca, which was a a large trading center, but it was also a center of pilgrimage. And if you start saying there's only one God, you might be severely curtailing the selling of trinkets and stuff to and motel rooms and meals and whatnot for people who come to the Black Stone of Abraham in the Kaaba, which was already there. See, so you eliminate all the gods but one. What kind of an illiberal, stupid thing is that? So Muhammad didn't make it in his hometown. He goes 250 miles north to Medina, and which was called Yathrib then, but became Medina, the city of the prophet. And he is attacked there, but he wins. And this famous battle of Badr was the turning point, or one of the turning points, that began to show Muhammad that he was on the right track, that Allah was with him, and that he was going to be victorious. Let me say one thing that's interestingly parenthetical at this point. Some of you will have a real sensitivity to this already, but I want to say it because it's so important for understanding today's world. From the Battle of Badr until the rise of the West in the Middle Ages, Islamic self-understanding very much organized itself around the success of Islam. The idea that God was with the Muslims, as Muhammad said he would be. And they experienced success after success after success. They were the greatest empire the world had ever seen, covered vast territory. The West seemingly was in decline, you know, the Dark Ages, so-called. Learning was down in the West. But in the Muslim countries, learning, science, arithmetic, for example, we get our word algorithm from the Arabs, and all sorts of scientific kinds. I mean, they were the king of the hill. And then what happened? They started to go downhill, and the West started to rise. The theological implications of that are vast. The psychological implications of that are vast for the Muslim world. I mean, Charles Waddell used to, you know, mention this quite a bit, this self-understanding of Islam. And so how easy it is, for example, for extremist factions to center around this idea of, well, you know, the arrogant West has beat us down and we must rise up. Or if you put it in a theological context, the problem is that we have gone away from our religious duties. We have not been good Muslims. We have not paid attention to the Sharia, which is the Muslim law. And so that's the argument, the theological argument of fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists. We must reinstate Islam in the center and not go the way of secular regimes. Is it getting warm in here? Too warm? Yeah. How do we make it not so warm in here? You want to, maybe those were open for a purpose to get some air circulating. I think that's it. Because I feel warm. I know it's cold outside. I just plug in.
Battery windows out here.
I think it's good enough to open those inner ones because there are two more. Why don't we open that one? Because I know you'll just beat yourself over the head if you miss any of this stuff. Then later on, you're like, oh, shoot. You know, I could have had a V8. So God is active in these revelatory events like the Exodus or like the Battle of Badr, where it became clear that Allah was with the people. God is transcendent, over everything, beyond, and yet imminent, with us. And all three of those sources, Jesus, Quran, and Muhammad, affirm that. The Islamic sources say God is closer to you than your carotid artery, which is here someplace, I guess. Okay? That's a pretty striking image, isn't it? God is that close. God who transcends all is yet near. Now, do you object to that language as a Christian? I don't. I think that that dynamic is certainly present in Christianity. Further, God is accessible. God is accessible through worship. God is accessible through prayer. All three of those sources affirm that. Further, they affirm that God is merciful. The surahs, or the chapters of the Quran, begin with, "In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful." Now, it is true, and you know, here's this kind of self-correction and criticism that can go on. While that is there in the Quranic materials, I would say, now here I'll get a little less modest, because I feel on firmer ground with Islam. I've read a lot of Islam. I've had wonderful teachers like the late Charles Waddell, who was a towering scholar, as you said, at his memorial, and unrecognized by the administration. I think that I've studied with some really fine people. And it's my sense that Islam stresses the kind of arbitrary judgment will of God. In contrast to, or shall we say complementarily to, the Christian stress on the loving, accepting, forgiving nature of God. Islam developed in a jurisprudential mode, as did Judaism. Christianity developed in a doctrinal mode, and that makes dialogue difficult at that level. And Kuhn is trying to break through that so that a dogmatic religion doesn't come in with the guns blazing, aiming at a religion which is very light on dogma, not on theological sophistication, but on dogma. It finds it very hard to define heresy, whereas it's real easy to define heresy within a doctrinal dogmatic tradition. Come in with guns blazing against another religion, which is not doctrinal, which is not dogmatic, but which stresses practice, like Islam. So God is gracious and merciful. King does not shy away from seeing the differences between the religions. And of course, this is a place where people can get misapprehensions and be misinformed. They hear dialogue, and what they imagine is that you ignore the differences, that all it is kind of like a tea party, you know, or a diplomatic reception where you're real careful, you know, you don't want to say anything that offends. You want to emphasize only what is common, and you don't want to talk about the differences, which really sounds to a lot of people like you don't want to get at the truth at all. You just want to be kind of superficially friendly. And of course, that's true. That's not what we're talking about in dialogue. You understand that there are differences, and not only differences of emphasis, but real differences of perceiving and expressing the encounter with the divine. That's an important phrase. Conceiving and expressing the encounter with the divine. Cantwell Smith and others will say that's the difference between faith and belief. He makes the statement the early Christians didn't believe. They had faith. The only way that you can believe is if you have options. And until very recently, people didn't have options. What were your options in the Middle Ages in Germany? You know, when Luther
died.
Believe or die, yeah. or believe or not believe, X. But you didn't have X, Y, and Z to choose from, and then you say, well, these are the two that I do not believe in or give my allegiance to, but I believe in Z. Right? Behind all of them is what Cantwell Smith calls faith, which can't be articulated. It cannot be spoken. It happens. It's an experience with, and then you have to say, X, or the transcendent, or the ultimate. But even as you say that, you're limiting, all right? You say God, you know, our Sri Lankan Buddhist friends will say, well, wait, I don't talk that language. And yet they will feel that they have had an encounter with that which is greater than themselves, with the transcendent, that which transcends their themselves. All right, so there are differences. But perhaps, says Kuhn, these differences are not mutually exclusive, but they are rather points of departure for dialogue. They're not mutually exclusive. God, as conceived in the Hebrew scriptures and in the Quran, is often angry and arbitrary. In Christianity, we see in Jesus' life God suffering with us, not only demanding love, but giving love, even to the undeserving. Are these mutually exclusive? Is the wrath of God against sin exclusive of an understanding of God as love? The Christian tradition wants to say God is love. The Islamic tradition does not speak in that way. You don't find God is love, but you find the love of God, the concept of the love of God in Islam, particularly in Sufism, which is mystical Islam, as you know. That is another important point. These religions are not monolithic. Religions are, well, even the term religion is problematic. But these religions contain strands of tradition. And some of them are stronger and some of them are weaker. Some of them are emphasized, some of them are de-emphasized over time. But there is no one Islam. There is no one Buddhism. As you say, there are numbers of Christianities. Yeah?
Bruce, can you help me get rid of some of my pessimism about all this? Do you find much accord in this direction among the theological seminaries of our mainline churches? What I'm getting at is, I personally think that, except for ecumenism, the unity of the churches, the church will increasingly become, as it has been becoming the last generation, irrelevant to society, unable to speak any clear word to any institution outside itself. And now you and others are saying, do this or die. I'm afraid we're choosing death. And I'm afraid that I don't see this thing snowballing. Mm-hmm. I don't even see the dialogue among the denominations as any popular thing.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of my pessimism, please.
there are indications. Rabbis teach, for example, at Lutheran seminaries. I think Berkeley has a rabbi. Know, sort of attached to the staff. That's important. But, you know, Cantwell Smith, who is old, I mean, he's emeritus professor. Did you have him when you were at Harvard?
He was there.
Yeah.
One time I was there, but I didn't study.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's a venerable old guy, you know, and he's saying we're just starting. We're in the very beginning stages of this. So, Cantwell Smith is optimistic because he thinks this is the truth. You know, that the truth in fact cannot be contained in the modern age or the postmodern age, whatever you want to call it. It simply cannot be contained and live. Truth is too big for these compartments. And so that's the place of optimism, I guess. Located in the inevitability of the strength of truth. But phenomenologically, yeah, it's yet to take place.
I guess the question has to do with grassroots.
Yeah, even grassrootier than the seminary.
Not only grassroots, but also the church councils, the head organizations, the bodies that govern.
Yeah. Well, there is, as you know, the World Council of Churches, as Mike mentioned, and they are fully committed to dialogue, including dialogue with those who think that dialogue is wrong, like evangelical Christians. I mean, there are ways to look at that, too. The World Council of Churches is in a whole lot of trouble, you know. And so, you know, you could say, well, yeah, they're trying to reach out to strengthen themselves and save themselves by drawing in the evangelicals. I don't know, but they are...
They are the closest body of the church that that speaks the truth that I know of,
yeah.
So I'm on the bandwagon.
Yeah. But, you know, the type of Christianity that seems to be successful these days is a type of Christianity that is scandalized by this kind of talk.
Yeah.
But, you know, I, again, modestly, and not as somebody who's thought this through completely, but it seems to me that these evangelical movements are retrograde. They are the flappings of something that is really already moribund. Why would they be so militant? Why would they be so chest-beatingly macho? You know, why should the fundamentalists that took over the Southern Baptist Convention and began to do so 10 years ago politically be so arrogantly happy that they have just run all the liberals out of the church? I think it's running scared. I mean, there could be other interpretations of that, but I think that they see the handwriting of postmodernity on the wall. That, as you say, just many, many people are going to find it irrelevant when people talk out of only one tradition. They know better, and that's something that I was emphasizing before, that one of the big differences between former eras going from, let's say, two generations ago backward is the amount of knowledge that we have, plus the context in which we have that knowledge, which is a context in which we are confronted personally with not only other options, but options which become less and less exotic because they're exemplified by people that we know. They're exemplified by the kids our kids go to school with, the mothers and fathers of those little Hindu kids that our kids go to school with. You know, and we a whole new horizon is opening for us. So we're in the very beginning stages, and one way I think you can look at these militant fundamentalist or evangelical movements that are still saying that God is going to give us a victory eventually, and these religions eventually will wither and die, or you know something, are really you know struggling with death, their own death. Yeah.
I'd like to be optimistic too, and I started ecumenical activities in the 60s, and actually that's how I got back into Christianity, was through living in yoga ashrams and living in Buddhist temples and coming back to Christian faith. And at that time there was sort of openness and people were interested in awakening mutually to knowledge and understanding. But I found that in the 80s that in Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam and Christianity, all politically, the political power went into militant fundamentalist, you know, the other phrase you used, movements.
Yeah.
That if you go to India, the Middle East, or you go to Southeast Asia or Japan, you find same fundamentalist, militaristic, conservative political parties moving with religious movements in the same direction.
Like Silk Road Mine.
Yeah, Silk Road Mine. And they're taking over power, like they are in India. They're terrified now that the fundamentalist Hindus are going to take over. And they're as evangelical as anybody.
Central America.
For Christians to evangelize. So it's, you know, it seems to be a world, a global event where there's an opening of dialogue, but at the same time there's this backlash, fear-based, military or conservative, but something very common.
But just as Nazism filled a vacuum and the churches for too long sat on the sidelines, so it seems to me today that our mainline churches are sitting on the sidelines. We are not demonstrating that we really care about the masses of people, or that our message get across, or that we have any use for mass media.
Yeah. Mark,
Martin, this place changed my mind.
Well, Marty is doing a five-year study. I think he's two or three years into this massive five-year study of fundamentalism around the world. So that'll be interesting to see what he and his colleagues come up with in terms of analysis of the rise of fundamentalism. Did you want to say something?
No, I'm just saying they're on the move. There's no doubt about it.
One hopeful sign, though, is to take a look at Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini, of course, represents probably one of the most frightful examples of this sort of thing. But you can only sustain that kind of power trip on that kind of a theological basis for a brief time. Iran is opening up.
Yeah.
The same thing goes for the Southern Baptists. You know, as the conservatives take over and solidify their control of the Southern Baptists, the moderates are starting to split off and form their own organizations that the centralized control deteriorates. And,
there's a lot that you said here is kind of over my head tonight. But
me too, I'm just reading it off the sheet.
But if I understand what you were talking about, I think the Christians within the Christian belief need to learn to talk and be able to do what you're saying that we need to do with other religions around the world. I mean, like Methodist, Baptist, Lutherans, because we've all kind of centered our, you know, those religions have kind of said, well, it's my belief that's right, okay?
Yeah.
And I think before you can do anything around the world, it's got to be done within the own Christian belief first. And I know people are beginning to do that, but there is still a lot of the old way where they don't open up and really talk.
Well,
you know, each one wants to believe their own way is right.
I would say it this way. They're parallel movements, and they interact with one another. The inner Christian dialogue among the, I wouldn't say religions, but the denominations. Yeah, like you said, Baptist, Lutheran, whatever, has to go on simultaneously with Christian theologians. And maybe you know, there is a grassroots movement also. But I'm kind of talking about a theological construction level of theologians who are talking across religious lines. So I would say, yeah, we have to get our act together too. I mean, it's scandalous for us to be apart. I mean, when we're looking at this global perspective.
Because if the theologians are, you know, you've got to have everybody doing it, not only just the theologians.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Yeah, there are various modes or levels. Yeah, but the only thing that I would take exception to is we've got to get our act together first. Man, that could be in the, you know, another 1,000 years before we get our act together.
Lutherans can't even agree.
Well, that's right, yeah. So, but as we talk with each other, these people are saying we should be talking at the same time with the recognition of other possibilities that can enrich our understanding of what we all acknowledge is beyond our capacity to put into word. That is God. Or the equivalent of God in other apprehensions of the ultimate. Yeah. You know, when you look at the earth as the blue marble, you know, like on the flag, the ecological flag, you know, it's just that little thing suspended there in space, you know. And you get the sense that, isn't it stupid that, you know, Presbyterians are warring with Lutherans. We can't afford that anymore. It's trivial. It's stupid. Yeah. Yeah. When we're, you know, killing the rainforests and
it's kind of
ozone
it's kind of anti-Christian for Christians to be doing what between the different faiths. I mean, it's totally different than what you're supposed to be believing in.
Mm-hmm. And Jesus prayed that we be one, that we be in harmony. Now, what does that mean against the global horizon? See, can we enrich our understanding of oneness beyond the borders of Christianity itself, is the question. Yeah?
I just think a couple of things. One is the credibility gap that we've got in Christianity in the world today. And Christianity was built on the faith of martyrs who witnessed to their faith by giving their lives. And I know very few Christians are willing to die for their faith anymore in this culture. So. And also that people are tired of complicated answers and problematic Christianity and want simple clarity. And unfortunately, you give them simple clarity, but they give them something else. It may not be good for us.
Mm-hmm.
But that becomes almost a compulsion that, please just give me something simple up there I can do and say and follow the guidelines, because the world's getting too complicated.
Granted, and at the same time, modernity is relentless. The influx into this country of people of other persuasions is relentless. And so this kind of cosmopolitanism is being borne in on even these people who don't want to think much about it anymore.
With
increasing force. Yeah, assuming we survive. So I think that the tack is that we've got to persevere and offer something that will help people make sense of their increasingly pluralistic understanding of reality.
My worst fantasy is in 500 years we'll all be fundamental Muslims.
We are officially at an end, so the service starts at 8, so those of you who want to stay behind and talk a little bit more are welcome to do that.
Trade places.
Okay. Yeah, feel free to stay. I'll go on with King a little bit if you want to. Is it that bad?
She went to Heart Lake.
That's
what I look like yesterday.
Huh?
She said you just put her foot to sleep.
Yeah. She didn't go to sleep.
So this book is in the bookstore?
No, this is not.
No.
But the book by Paul Nitter.
Oh, that's
is,
right. That's
and that's the one,
that's
if you're interested in the subject at all, boy, that's the book to get, because it's got all the possible positions in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I knew that one was in there.
Yeah.